एवं विक्लपितो राजन् विदुषा मुनिनापि सह प्रश्रयावनतोभ्यः प्रजाकामस्ततो मुनिम्। एवं विकल्पितो राजन् विदुषा मुनिनापि सह प्रश्रयावनतो राजा Ladies, please. एवं दस विकल्पितः क्वेश्चन्ड राजन् ओ किंग परीक्षित विदुषा ग्रेटली लर्नड मुनिना बाय द फिलोसोफर अपि ऑल्दो सह ही किंग चित्रकेतु प्रश्रय अवनतः being bent low due to humility. Abhyaha replied, Prajakamaha, desiring offspring, Tataha, thereafter, Munim, to the great sage. Translation and purports by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So I'm going to read a few translations. I think I missed the first part yesterday. I think Daita read a couple of verses. So this is text 18. O King, O Lord of humanity, when a king directly depends upon his associates, who's speaking? King Angira Rishi. O King, O Lord of humanity, when a king directly depends upon his associates and follows their instructions, he is happy. Similarly, when his associates offer their gifts and activities to the king and follow his orders, they are also happy. Text 19. O King, are your wives, citizens, secretaries and servants and the merchants who sell spices and oil under your control? Are you also in full control of ministers, the inhabitants of your palace, your provincial governors, your sons and your other dependents? Text 20. If the king's mind is fully controlled, all his family members and governmental officers are subordinate to him. His provincial assistants, and what to speak of lesser servants. And the purport says, Angira Rishi asked the king whether his mind was also under control. This is most essential for happiness. Text 21. O King Chitraketu, I can observe that your mind is not pleased. You seem not to have achieved your desired goal. Is this because of you yourself, or has it been caused by others? Your pale face reflects your deep anxiety. And this morning's verse, text 22. Shukadeva Goswami said, O King Parikshit, although the great sage Angira knew everything, he inquired from the king in this way. Thus King Chitraketu, desiring a son, bent low in great humility and spoke to the great sage as follows. Purport. Since the face is the index to the mind, a saintly person can study the condition of one's mind by seeing his face. When Angira Rishi remarked about the king's discolored face, King Chitraketu explained the cause of his anxiety as follows. Text 23. King Chitraketu said, O great Lord Angira, because of austerity, knowledge, and transcendental samadhi, you are freed from all the reactions of sinful life. Therefore, as a perfect yogi, you can understand everything external and internal regarding embodied conditioned souls like us. Text 24. O great soul, you are aware of everything, yet you are asking me why I am full of anxiety. Therefore, in response to your order, let me disclose the cause. 25. As a person aggrieved by hunger and thirst is not pleased by the external gratification of flower garlands or sandalwood pulp, I am not pleased with my empire, opulence, or possessions, which are desirable even for great demigods, because I have no son. Therefore, O great sage, please save me and my forefathers who are descending to the darkness of hell because I have no progeny. Kindly do something so that I may have a son to deliver us from hellish conditions. Purport. According to Vedic civilization, one gets married simply to have a son who is needed to offer oblations to his forefathers. King Chitraketu responsibly desired to beget a child so that he and his forefathers might be delivered from the darkest regions. He was concerned with how to get pinda oblations in the next life, not only for himself but also for his forefathers. Therefore, he requested Angira Rishi to favor him by doing something that could help him get a son. 27. In response to the request of Maharaj Chitraketu, Angira Rishi, who was born of Lord Brahma's mind, was very merciful towards him. Because the sage was a greatly powerful personality, he performed a sacrifice by offering oblations of sweet rice to Tvashta. Remember Tvashta? Okay, we'll come back to that. Text 28. O Parikshit Maharaj, best of the Brahmanas, the remnants of the food offered in the Yajna were given by the great sage Angira to the first and most perfect among Chitraketu's millions of queens, whose name was Kritadyuti. Text 29. Thereafter, the great sage told the king, O great king, now you will have a son who will be the cause of both jubilation and lamentation. The sage then left without waiting for Chitraketu's response. Purport. In the sloka, he uses the word or phrase Harsha Shoka Pradastubhyam. The word Harsha means jubilation and Shoka means lamentation. The king was overwhelmed with joy when he understood that he would have a son. Because of his great jubilation, he could not actually understand the statement of the sage Angira. He accepted it to mean that there would certainly be jubilation because of the birth of his future son, but that it would be the king's only son and, being very proud of his great wealth and empire, would not be very obedient to his father. Thus the king was satisfied, thinking, let there be a son, it does not matter if he's not very obedient. In Bengal, there is a proverb that instead of having no maternal uncle, it is better to have a maternal uncle who is blind. Better a blind uncle than no uncle. Than no uncle. Better to have a blind one. The king accepted this philosophy, thinking that a disobedient son would be better than no son at all. The great sage Chanakya Pandita said, Ko artha putrena jatena, ko na vidvan na dharmikaha, kanena chakshusha kimva, chakshu pidaiva kevalam. Quote, what is the use of a son who is neither a learned scholar nor a devotee? Such a son is like a blind, diseased eye which always causes suffering. Nevertheless, the material world is so polluted that one wants to have a son even though he is useless. This attitude was represented in the history of King Chitraketu. Let's see if I can get further in the pastime, but we'll come back. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chaksur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Vishnam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Swapadantikam Namam Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishthaya Bhutale Shri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Vancha Kalpaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shriva Sadigora Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The face is the index to the mind. A saintly person can study the condition of one's mind by seeing his face. There is the soul proper, and this soul is in two casings or two bodies. One is called the subtle body, sukshma deha, and the other is called the gross body, sthula deha. And it's not that they're all not connected or integrated. Each of them is connected. And they're connected by the mind, because the mind directs the senses, and the mind experiences, or through the mind the soul experiences feelings. And the way the gross body is connected to the subtle body, in many other ways, but in this particular context, that whatever happens in the mind brings about some physiological changes. Meaning, the gross body responds to the inner workings of the mind. For example, when someone is angry, you see certain physiological changes. The teeth clench, the fists clench, the eyes become big, the nostrils flare, for example. Or if someone's feeling very sad, the eyes, they move or droop in a particular way, tears come, the face goes from this to a sad face. If someone is very worried or anxious, you'll see that on their forehead many lines manifest. The eyes, they don't focus the same way, etc. Guilt, shame, when someone's happy, their pupils dilate. Now there is a whole science behind this. And the great sages or persons who are spiritually elevated, they understand. And they can read a person's mind just from their face, or let's include body language. Now in America, there is so much talk about body language that when you go for an interview or you're meeting someone, it's very important how your body language is. Your chest is open, so it's inviting, you're confident, you shake hands with a firm, and you sit straight, you don't, you know, one foot, one is over the other, that shows casual. You sit like, you know, the whole study of body language. We were taught when you're making a presentation, how to stand, how, what to do, what not to do. And when you're speaking with someone, certain things mean some things. Now, of course, in the Eastern cultures, those body languages mean a totally different thing. Therefore, there is always this, why is that body language, right? For example, the famous Indian head nod or head bob, whatever you call it, right? You don't know what we are saying. Are we saying yes? Are we saying no? We don't know. So it's always a confusion, body language. And this is important because person understands, even without without Chitraketu speaking anything, Angira knew there is something that is bothering this Prabhuji. In fact, he also knew what it was that was bothering him. But he could read because the face is the index of the mind. In Ramayana, there's a beautiful pastime about this face is the index of the mind. After 14 years, Lord Ramachandra is returning to Ayodhya. He has killed Ravana, he has got Sita back, he has revived all the monkeys and bears that died in the fight. He asked Indra to revive all of them, so nobody died actually. Everyone became physically strong like before the war. And he was flying back with Sita Devi. And as they fly back, Lord Ramachandra goes back in chronology, narrating all the incidents that happened from the time they came to Lanka, like a Ramayana spoke backwards, all the way to Panchavati, where that's where you were kidnapped, like etc., etc. And they come to the outskirts of Ayodhya. And the word spreads like wildfire that Lord Ramachandra is back. Now the situation is such that Bharata is the king. He's the king who's ruling on behalf of Lord Ramachandra. At least that's what Bharata said when Lord Ramachandra was leaving. That this is your kingdom. I will not take it. I will rule it on your behalf. So Bharata comes with his armies and all the sages to receive Lord Ramachandra outside the city gates. And Ramachandra doesn't go. He sends Lakshmana. And he tells Lakshmana, when you meet Bharat, look him in the eye and tell him, Rama has returned, and you read his face. Even if there is a slight twitch in the eye, if his eye moves even a little bit of hesitation, then we will not take this kingdom. That means he is sad to give it up, and I don't want that. So read carefully his eyes and his face, his countenance. So when Lakshmana says to Bharata, Ramachandra is back. It's described that Bharata's face showed so much jubilation, tears and happiness that he didn't care for the kingdom. Because the tendency is when someone is sitting on such a seat, Ayodhya was such a strong country, or the seat of the emperor, and one can get attached. Even a few days, even a few moments, one can become very attached to something and feel, this is mine, when it is not ours. So Lord Ramachandra didn't want even to do anything with the kingdom if he felt that Bharata was attached to being the king. So that's how face was read. So when we visit or meet with a spiritual master, we think Oh, I will say it in this way. I will use these words. I will not react to something. But it all plays out on our face, one after the other. It's like a movie, and the spiritual just has to look and knows exactly what's going on. Because that is our face. It's not like we are great actors either, right? Even if we say, I'll be a poker face, I will not respond. But somewhere, some emotion, something will touch, and it all shows up on the face, even without our knowing. They know. That is how it is. The face is the index of the mind. From the eyes, from the movement of things, everything, it's clear. You know, the face color also changes. And people can tell something's going on. Now, what to speak, the rest of the body is also speaking something, right? This body language also. So Angira Rishi knew, but he asked Chitraketu, what's happening? You seem a little anxious. So he says, what can I say? You already know. I don't have a son. And it is bothering me very much because I feel that for myself and for my forefathers, there is no deliverance from the hellish condition. The word used in Sanskrit is putra. Now, putra means, like we say, mantra, trayate, one that relieves the mind. So putra means to relieve from this hellish condition called put. There's a place where the forefathers who have, because of being in a bodily condition, they enter that hellish place, and the next generation is supposed to perform oblations to Lord Vishnu to relieve the previous generations from that condition. So King Chitraketu is worried. If I don't have a son, how will myself and my forefathers be relieved from this very horrible condition? So please, do something. Help me. So Angira Rishi, who is born from the mind of Lord Brahma, he performs a particular yajna. Now in Vedic history, such yajnas are very, very common, in which they offer sweet rice in the yajna, and that sweet rice becomes very potent, energized, charged up. King Dasarath did that, right? When King Dasarath did, this wonderful blazing personality came out of the fire and he gave a bowl of sweet rice. Something about sweet rice. That Dasharath Maharaj gave half to Kausalya. From the half that was remaining, he gave half to Sumitra. And half, or from that half, again, another half was given to Kaikeyi. And that what was remaining, the 1/8, was given back to Sumitra. So 4 sons were born. This was called the Praja Kama or Putra Kama Yajna. When King Drupada, he was insulted by Dronacharya. He became very angry. And he said, I must kill Drona. So he performed this fantastic fire yajna. Rice came and said, you will have 2 children, and the other will be called Draupadi. Tvashta performed a fire yajna and got who? Vritrasura. Now that was this pastime that happens later. So, but before this, the sweet rice was, or the oblations were offered to Tvashta. So then a pot of sweet rice was given. And when Kritadyuti, she ate the remnants of sweet rice, and then Angira blessed Kiramuni. He blessed King Chitraketu that you will have a son who will be Harshashoka Pradastubhyam. Prada means to give or to offer. Harshashoka, possibility after 10 million wives and it did not work out. Oh, there's a Shoka part. Or even if he heard it, he didn't foolish or will give me a lot of suffering than to not have a son at all. Because I'm anyway suffering. I'd rather suffer with a son, says the Bengali proverb. Better to have a blind in Chanakya Pandita Jatena. Ko artha means what's the use? What's the benefit of having a son? Yona vidvan na dharmikaha. One or one religious. Because also knows how to take care of himself. Because he will take the latter will take care of himself by following religious principles. The vidvan, and he'll be good. But if one is neither, then what's the point? In fact, he might cause more damage to himself and to society. Previous canto, treating his youngest child, son, because they were all learned, he would do everything opposite or in wrong order. They would tell him, okay, he would not respond. He would take a bath, pass two. Like, we'd remain muti, like, whole day. Or he would do things totally opposite. So they thought, oh, totally, will my son live his life? Let me try to teach him something. And the father also tried. But Jadabharata didn't learn anything. So he says, Chanakya Pandita compares such a son to Deva Kevalam. Pida means suffering or misery. Kaanena chakshusha kimva. That blind, a lot of suffering. It doesn't have to be deceased. Even one eyelash in the eye is such an irritation. And is such, until you that lash goes away. Right? We have that experience. Or there is some distress in the eye that completely absorbs anything we can do. So he's saying, what is the use? A son that is neither learned or nor religious is like a diseased eye that causes lot of suffering. Therefore, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. Therefore, the responsibility of parenting is not a joke. It is not, like Prabhupada would say, don't have children like cats and dogs. Because cats and dogs have litter. Literally, it's called litter. So having children is not the point. Doing something to train them, that is the critical fact. Very good, very good. Great. He will be a great source of joy. But he didn't hear or he didn't consider what the shoka part would be. If he was in his right condition, he would pause and ask Angira Muni, what did you mean? He'll be the source of lamentation for me. What should I be worried about? And Angira also, interestingly, he didn't wait. It's described that the sage left without waiting. The son will be the source of jubilation and lamentation. Turned around and walked away.
What do you call it, in pain? So if so, then doesn't that kind of when they weren't, doesn't that mean that they're not attached to the material body activities or something like that?
If you read Bhagavad Gita, especially chapter 6 and chapter 18, although they're not necessary, they don't have to, they don't build work. Yet, a sannyasi is supposed to light a fire, meaning perform Vedic Yajna. We are a sannyasi, yet we are getting the disciples married and we perform. Disciple is Chitraketu. Another reason is Angira Muni wants Chitraketu to learn a lesson. Well, Chitraketu has not been learning with 10 million something, by which he will get a child who will be the source of that lamentation will break that attachment to material. Correct? So that suffering, Angira, instead of teaching him in a way that he doesn't suffer, allowed for it him to learn the hard way. Sometimes you give it time and then you let it happen such that they may learn it the hard way. What to do? 8:20.
Lots, but attachment to material desires causes us suffering, just like King Chitraketu, he wanted to suffer. And then eventually, you know, the other wives killed the son. I'm not sure if that came, but that didn't come up yet. So
it's going to come up.
Always come up. You know, other than Christian consciousness, basically. So in this regard, you know, the Bhagavatam was written by Vyasadeva, and he was dissatisfied. He described basically dharma, artha, kama, moksha, how people can enjoy. So we find verses like the one that Prabhupada quotes in 4:11, where he says, akama, sarva, kama, va, moksha, kama, udada, di, that regardless of one's desires, whether one desires, has no desires, desires liberation, or desires everything, no, he should still engage in bhakti yoga. So it kind of seems like a contradiction there. Like, is he encouraging, you know, desires, or is it like a gradual process? I mean, one thing I thought of was one class you gave, you know, many years ago. You said it's not called, like, siddha bhakti. It's not called perfection bhakti. It's called sadhana bhakti. There's a practice, and it's a gradual process. And it's not like we start perfectly. So if you could expand on that, maybe.
May I have a Bhagavad Gita while I'm saying thank you? The issue is not that one doesn't have or one should be free of material desires. Yeah. We want to become free of material desires. Because desire causes attachment. Sangat sanjayate kama dhyayato vishayan pumsam is the desire, dhyana. Oh, how nice it would be to sanjat sanjayate kama. That kama means the attachment, it develops that contemplation on that desire continues in such a way that it becomes highly like intense lust, that I must have it. And that's because of attachment. Sangat sanjayate kama. So the idea is not that, oh, everyone should be free of desires right at the get-go. Desires may come, but one should not be attached to those desires. That's the point. And the way to become detached from the desires is tivrena bhakti yogena. That one engages in strong devotional service, because bhakti has the capacity and the potency to relieve one of the attachments. So it is described, keep doing. Just like the mind, we say to chant Hare Krishna, one's mind should be very peaceful. But we start with, I don't have a peaceful mind. We say, no, keep chanting. The mind will become trained. So therefore it says, akama sarva kama va moksha kama udaradi. It also means that anyone and everyone is eligible for bhakti. Not only those who have conquered over their desires. Everyone is eligible for bhakti. And if one continues, then one will become free. Man, where is that verse? I can't find that verse. I know what it is, but Kuto Shanti. Can't remember it. It's without peace. For a person whose mind is not stable. I also felt second, but I can't. Yes. Yes, thank you. Nasti buddhir ayuktasya nacha yuktasya bhavana nacha bhavayata shantir. So Angira Muni is saying what's going on. So Krishna says, one who's not connected with the Supreme Presence nor a steady mind of peace. And how can there be any happiness without peace? So the mind is disturbed because there's no particular goal, Prabhupada writes in the purport. Disturbed Koros King Chitraketu's goal, Kerasan. That's not an ultimate goal. It's a material goal. And because the goal itself is, and when the mind is, so you reverse it back, comes from a peaceful mind. Peaceful mind comes from spiritual goal. Therefore, we see that one who is very clear in what they want from life, if one wants ultimately that I want Krishna consciousness, then even in the most disturbing circumstances, one will consider, what's my goal? And is this circumstance worth deviating from the goal? And so the person remains peaceful, even in such, as we say, disturbing conditions. And then that steadiness comes, he says, nacha buddhir ayuktasya. The key word there is yukta. Yukta means connected. One who's connected to Krishna, such a person's intelligence is fixed. That intelligence is the one that keeps the mind steady. Hey, stay here. Don't go anywhere. And if one is not connected to Krishna, then the intelligence says, do whatever you like, I don't care.
I think I remember a reading where when one transcends the modes of nature, the goal is already reached.
Uh-huh.
Have you heard that one? Oh, it's quite some time ago, so it's a little foggy, but I remember reading that somewhere. I think it was in the Krishna book or something.
Three more.
Hare Krishna. I was wondering this point that one can read a person's mind through his face.
It says a great sage can read the mind through his face.
Yeah. It was interesting that still Angira Muni was inquiring, even though Chitraketu Maharaj himself kind of confessed, you must know, but still Angira Maharaj was inquiring.
Yes.
Because one might be able to read the emotions, but one wouldn't necessarily be able to read, or let's say interpret the emotion, understand what is the cause, understand these other factors. We're just reading the pastime of King of the Demon Ritrasura, so this topic has been coming up of like external vision and trying to ascertain what's behind it. It's not a clear thing. So I was appreciating that even though Angira Muni, perhaps he knew the cause actually of Chitraketu Maharaj's lamentation, still he was very respectfully kind of inquiring to perhaps to be sure, or I don't know.
It's not to be sure. In the case of Angira Muni, he knew exactly what was going on, what was the things, what were the things that were leading to King Chitraketu's lamentation, etc. In the case of Vritrasura and Indra, Indra is reading or whatever, is on the basis of externalities. It's different. Indra is on a different platform compared to Angira Muni. In the first canto, when Narada Muni appears in front of Vyasadeva, there also Narada knows what's going on. He asks the sage, oh, what is, you're so perfect in your studies, you're very controlled in your senses, your determination is very fixed. What is the problem? In the 18th, 19th chapter of the first canto, when Parikshit Maharaj comes and sees Dharma the bull, three legs broken, shivering, and Dhatri or the cow crying, with the Shudra holding the club in the hand, Parikshit Maharaj asks the bull, who has done this to you? So there are different reasons why these personalities ask. In the case of Parikshit Maharaj, he's asking to, because he's the administrator, he wants to get a statement from the plaintiff, that, because he doesn't want to assume anything. We talked about what's called circumstantial evidence at that time. Just because it's like this, he's holding the club, someone's holding a smoking gun, you don't assume that that's what the person who's done. So he's asking from him the statement, a victim's statement, before he can give his judgment as the referee or the arbitrator. Just so that as a king he doesn't perform a mistake. Because according to such justice, a person is considered innocent until proven guilty. What we normally apply is a person is guilty until proven innocent. Because in the court of law, one has to prove one's innocence. In the olden times, the person's guilt had to be proven. This is a difference, but significant one. In the case of Narada Muni and Vyasadeva, Vyasadeva already knows what it is. And Narada is just bringing it out. In this case, he's the guru and he's asking his disciple, you express it. Because when a person expresses his lamentation, they take responsibility for that lamentation, that situation. So it's part of training the disciple. That's why he says he was bowing down low in humility and he says, yes, but I don't have a son. It is for him to express it. You want to say something? Oh.
Just one. I was just thinking, we hear from a guru's perspective, he never thinks of himself as a guru. Mm-hmm. So perhaps out of humility, he had some strong hunch, but out of humility to confirm. This is what I was thinking.
No, it's not that guru doesn't think of his mind. He's very clear what his role is. He's come for a very specific purpose.
Is that to say
that's not out of humility? Well,
my question then is, does a liberated personality pose as a liberated personality?
I mean, do they walk around thinking I'm liberated?
Yeah, exactly. I'm Tri Kalajna, I know everything.
I don't think that's what goes into their consciousness. But then they have some sense of it. Narada travels everywhere, not like I'm Trikalagya, I know past, present and future. But they have a sense of what's happening in the hearts of people. It's an empowerment given by Krishna, so they know. That's about it. He knows. Angira knows. And he's come to assist his disciple. Oh, he's struggling with something. Let me see what I can do. On behalf of Krishna, let me see what I can do for him. It's that. Although when someone's very attached
and they're in the presence of the spiritual master, the spiritual master, when asked the disciple what the issue is, it is like trying to put a pause in the thought that you're attached to, because when you're attached, the mind is so absorbed that it runs with the idea. So sometimes taking the pause helps. So when a spiritual master or somebody who's guiding, you know, asks the question, there's a pause there actually. And depending upon how the disciple reacts to the pause, guidance is given. Sometimes for some people, taking the pause helps them, oh my God, where am I going? And if that's where their consciousness goes, then their guidance is giving, oh, this is not good for you. This is the instruction. But in spite of taking the pause, if the person is still lamenting, still attached, then the story of Chitraketu, like, you know, then they... Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
The Prabhupada gave a whole class about something. The dangers of something, I forget it. And, he gave a class on divorce. That one should not, according to Vedic Sarasana, one is not encouraged to take divorce, one should not, or something, heavy class. And right after class, one of his disciples came and said, Prabhupada, my marriage is in this very situation, may I? And Prabhupada said yes. So the other was like, I just thought this morning you were like heavy about it. And Prabhupada said he would do it anyway. So he'd rather have my sanction. That way, even if he's done something that's not proper, it is still within the boundary of my sanction, so he's protected. But if he does something that I haven't sanctioned, then falls off the cliff. And who's going to do that soul? So he would do it anyway, so it's okay. So, exactly, that is...
Yeah, decisions cannot be made when you're in a very attached place. So if you want to make a decision on the platform of soul, one needs to pause and come to the platform of goodness.
Yes.
Right?
Okay, anything else? Jai Baldi. Yeah, there's no rush.
Well, you will buy it.
No, because multiple things happening.
This is in regards to Luke's question about, like, a guru who may say, you know, who they don't think, I'm a guru. He doesn't walk around telling everyone, I'm a guru, obviously. So this reminds me of Prabhupada when he first came to America and started associating with the hippies. And they would kind of informally call him Swamiji's, but he never said anything about it. And then one day they would, you know, is it that the Super Soul inspired them to ask, what should we call you, is Swamiji respectful? So, and so then he was like, well, you know, a more proper term would be called, what did he say? Prabhupada, or no, he didn't say Prabhupada, I know, but
he gave them different alternatives when they came up with the term Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah, more respectful alternatives. So is it that a devotee whose peer is that automatically a super soul inspired people to be attracted to them to derive wisdom, and they'll disclose their position then, not that they automatically come and say, take wisdom from me, etc. So is that the case?
No, it's not like that. A guru is very clear, he's guru. And he will exercise his position as guru. There's no doubt in that. In fact, a guru exercising his position as guru is his humility. Just as Krishna exercises his position as I am the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is his humility, because he's acting in a position of truth. What they're free of is the pride that I am something. But they have a role, and they're very clear. I am guru, I'm meant to instruct such and such person, and this is my service. But it's not like, I am guru, everybody has a... It's just not the mood. They're very clear. Very clear. Prabhupada was very clear. I am the spiritual master for these devotees. And he acted in that role very clearly. I mean, you couldn't mess with Prabhupada, right? Some disciple couldn't say, come on, no. He was very clear. Back to his point, it's not like Prabhupada is thinking, I'm liberated soul, I can do anything. That's not the point though. You want to add something? Yeah, it's all right. You got the mic.
It seems on this topic of the mood of a spiritual master, there's it's somewhat like intricate and more, let's say, complex. In addition to this mood that you're describing, we hear statements from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada, like, one who thinks he's a guru is a guru. And also Srila Prabhupada, observing or appreciating that all of my disciples are simply the servants of my spiritual master, whom he has sent to assist me in executing his mission.
Sure.
So, it seems there are multiple apparently conflicting perspectives going on within the mind and heart of such an exalted devotee.
Sure. I don't see conflict. Or the reason being, those statements, one who thinks of himself guru is no better than guru, is the pride that comes from that position. That's the point there. But it's very clear, Prabhupada sat on some really high vyasasans. In fact, there's a pastime. You know, recently we were talking at the lunch table. I'll say it just because it's really fantastic. Srila Prabhupada was invited by some Mayavadis for a Gita conference. And the guest of honor was some Mayavadi. And Prabhupada was one of the other panel members. So when Prabhupada was reluctant to go, but they invited, Prabhupada said, all right, we'll go. And when they came to the auditorium, there was a high seat on the stage, like a real big seat, and other chairs for the other members. That big seat was for this guest of honor, Mayavadi. Prabhupada walked on stage, went and sat on that high seat. And the organizers became uncomfortable. Oh, they wanted to say, Swamiji, that is your seat. But they couldn't tell him because he's also no small timer, right? Prabhupada is Prabhupada. Prabhupada sat there. So the guest of honor had to sit on the small seat. And then Prabhupada spoke on the Bhagavad Gita. Others spoke their different Mayavadi interpretations. Prabhupada spoke clearly. Krishna is the person, the whole, you know, as it is. And then it was turned for the guest of honor to speak. And when the mic came to him and he just started speaking something Mayavadi, like really almost opposite of what Prabhupada said, Prabhupada turned to the devotees and said, have kirtan. Right in the middle of his speech, they broke into this loud kirtan, completely eclipsing his person's words. The whole thing. The organizer became very upset. Prabhupada then got off chin high and walked. Very clear. He knows what he's... But there's no arrogance though. And Prabhupada would say, I'm your spiritual master, I'm instructing you. But the mood within is, I'm servant of Krishna. So when Prabhupada, when Bhaktisiddhanta sat on Vyasasan, it was his Vyasaputra. And one after the other, they were all glorifying. Oh, Guru Maharaj, you like this, you like that. At the end of it, when it was his turn to address, he said, all of you have given me so many instructions today. It's a nice topic.
Yeah, this. I think I'm completely satisfied after mentioning this. What you mentioned this point. He was always completely identified simply as a servant of Krishna. This service, that service. In one sense, it's like a mundane designation. Of course, there's nothing mundane about it. But it's just a temporary role that has, in one sense, nothing to do with the eternal...
Since you're saying temporary role, say it's a function on behalf of Krishna, right? So that someone doesn't feel, what do you mean? But so it's a function on behalf of Krishna, that there is no pride in it. It's a service to do. Thank you.
Another seating arrangement for Srila Prabhupada was at the Evanston Temple. They had a nice Vyasa San forum in this, all these reporters came. It wasn't in the temple room, it was in his quarters there. And Prabhupada sat on the floor. Yeah. And the reporter said, well, they have a nice seat for you. Why don't you sit on the seat? And he said, because you become more envious of me.
Prabhupada knew how to exactly address each person's heart and in the best ways. Yesterday Dayatu spoke on Monday when one of the reporters asked Prabhupada, why are your disciples driving you in a Rolls Royce? He said, Rolls Royce. Actually, they should be driving me in a golden chariot. Because Sakshat Dharitva, a spiritual master, is a representative of Krishna. He should be actually driving a golden chariot. This is really Rolls Royce.
One other thing is, Prabhupada was coming through the airport, and some of the senior devotees said, Prabhupada, we have enough money to buy you a Learjet. And Prabhupada says, no, then that would be, they would become even more envious.
At the same time, back to the humility point that Luke was bringing up. Once in the airport, Srila Prabhupada was there, the devotees were there, and the kirtan was really complete ruckus. And so the airport authorities complained, can you quieten it down? Can you guys sit on that side or something? So one of the devotees stood up and said, all ISKCON devotees, can you please move to this side? Srila Prabhupada got up from his seat, picked up his bag, walked to, oh, no, Prabhupada, not you. I'm also an ISKCON devotee. He was not like, oh, it's for everyone else. Yes, for me also. Or sometimes he was asked, he was talking something about pure devotees. So the reporter or someone said, Swamiji, how many pure devotees are there in your movement? He turned to his secretary and said, how many devotees are there in our movement? He gave some number. So many pure devotees. Yes, Jai Baldev.
We should take from this discussion, like,
which discussion?
We shouldn't ever, this present discussion about the guru, that we shouldn't categorize, as practicing devotees, of course, you know, for us, should we not categorize a guru? Other people who may see him from a distance, just like when Prabhupada was in Paris, he sat on a Vyasa sign on the stage, and then the youth, you know, started criticizing him, and it became a bad thing because they didn't like, you know, the leaders back then. Of course, theirs is a different case, but for practicing devotees, should the lesson be that we shouldn't necessarily group our, you know, the ideal of what a spiritual master should do? Because we may read the scripture and say, oh, he should do this, he should be humble, but that doesn't appear to be humble because it's like a list of things.
So Rupa Goswami tells us, drishtair svajaniter vapushashadoshair. The one should not think the spiritual master is ordinary, even if seemingly he has physical deformities or some seemingly making mistakes, whatever it is, it's all external. One cannot understand, one should not make, or one should not feel that the spiritual master is ordinary. He is not. He is directly empowered by Krishna. Krishna may empower him in a certain way to say and do things just to bring out stuff from our heart. So it may seem like, oh, Prabhupada misquoted the whole shloka there. Something. But this is just to bring out in us the doubtful nature. That we have to notice, oh, Krishna is doing something here. Krishna is very tricky. Among all the personalities, Krishna is the trickiest. He knows how to play around with our heart in such a way that he's constantly exposing our own situation. He may use anyone for it, but he's exposing our situation. Guru is very, one should be very careful. It doesn't mean one should not have an open relationship, but one should be careful to not think of him as ordinary. He's not. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Bhagavatam ki jai.